Macworld Podcast number 346 for March 13th, 2013. Welcome to another Macworld Podcast. I'm Chris Breen. Recently, our sister publication, TechHive, ran a series of articles from tech luminary Andy Anatko that outlined his many reasons for switching from the iPhone to an Android-based Samsung Galaxy S3. Like many people, I was curious to hear more of Andy's thoughts, so I gave him a jingle and he was kind enough to spare nearly an hour to expand on what he had to say in his articles. Before praising or damning his decision, I hope you'll take the time to listen to what he actually had to say. And here we go. I'm joined by Chicago Sun-Times technology columnist, Macworld contributor, MacBreak Weekly regular, host of the Anatko Almanac podcast, and man about town, Andy Anatko. Welcome to the Macworld podcast, Andy.
You left out Gadfly.
Ah, and Gadfly.
I realized I only got my certification 4 months ago, but...
Yeah, no, I hadn't checked your LinkedIn page since then, so now I know. Recently, you penned a series of articles for TechHive, which we at Macworld also had a chance to look at, and it explained why you switched from the iPhone to an Android-based Samsung Galaxy S3. Now, a lot of writers do this as kind of a stunt. You know, they have a device, and then they put it down for a month, and they pick up another device and say, oh, and they describe the terrible pain or the joy of using this thing, and then they go back to what they were using before. But in your case, this isn't a stunt. You've actually changed devices. So can you explain why you did that?
Yes, but first, it's not exactly – I do that a lot. It's not exactly a stunt. I review a lot of different devices over the course of a year, and I do get to play with pretty much every new phone that comes out. And I do find that I'm such a devoted iPhone user. I mean, I've been using one since like the day one of revision one. And so I'm so used to the way that iPhones work that I kind of have to put the iPhone aside and use this new Android phone or this new BlackBerry or this new Windows phone device exclusively for a couple of weeks just so I can shed away all my expectations of, oh, this is not working the way that the iPhone works. Because sometimes not working the way the iPhone works is actually a good thing, not necessarily a bad thing, but it takes you a while to do that. So it's not necessarily a stunt that you put something aside for a while. But yeah, there was a big change this time because Google had made a lot of improvements in Android in the previous two iterations, because I've reviewed the very first Android phone that came out with Android. I think it shipped with Android 1.5, 1.6, and it was a nice effort, but certainly nothing you could take seriously, certainly nothing I was going to recommend. Android 2.0 came out, and that was at least good enough that I could say, if you feel as though you're locked into Verizon or Sprint or whatever carrier that is not AT&T and you don't want to switch carriers because iPhone is an AT&T exclusive, this is at least serviceable. It's not nearly as good as an iPhone, but if you can't get an iPhone on your current carrier and you can't switch, okay, this will do you. 3.0 was kind of a skip year for Android. It wasn't really very good. But 4.0 was the first really solid, really mature version of the operating system that had a lot of nice features hardwired into it, a lot of nice new features and a lot of old features that had really found its way into maturity. On top of everything else, Google had managed to roll back a little bit on their policy of making this a, you know, Happy Valley hippie community of developers saying, oh, no, please, it's our job just to release the source code and then you guys write whatever apps you want and make them do whatever you think they should. And over the previous year or two, they realized that this is not resulting in top drawer software being written. So they said, well, here's some rules that we want to impose upon you, and here are some guidelines for how to develop a really good user interface that works well with all the dingbats that we have put into this operating system. And as a result, it became a really compelling platform. At the same time, companies like HTC and Samsung started producing wonderful devices. These prestige top drawer phones, you know, these banner bearers for the entire line, that they're not designed to be these subsidized phones that you buy in a blister pack behind the counter at the drugstore for $50 and then pay-as-you-go contract. These are designed to be real flagship phones, and be as emphatic a statement about how good this company is at designing hardware as Apple makes a statement when they release an iPhone. And what was happening was that I would have this phone to test out for about a month or so, and then I'd go through my testing process. I would write my review. I would hang on to it for another 2 or 3 weeks after the review, and then I would send it back. And then I would go back to my iPhone, and all along I'd be using both phones side by side. But when I went back to just using the iPhone, there'd be so many features that I would kind of miss out on, and one of the big ones was a legitimately larger screen. It got so hard to switch back to let's be kind and call it a compact mm-hmm. design of the iPhone 4S after using the 4.8 inch screen of the Samsung Galaxy S3, because for me, just the larger screen made everything better. My phone spends a lot of time on my car dashboard as a navigation tool, far, far better. As just simply a media player where the buttons are big and easy to read and easy to hit, much, much better. When I'm actually at the coffee shop and I want to read a book, or I want to catch up on my news feeds, or even just watch a movie, again, so much bigger, so much better. And of course, I was very familiar with the usual complaint that a lot of commentators have made about, oh, well, Android phones, it's just a gimmick. It's just like when you go into the TV department at Target or Walmart, and of course they amp up the color and they amp up the sharpness to give you this artificial sense that it's better when it's really not better at all. And I really had to say, no, it's not just people aren't just gravitating to these larger phones because they are physically a larger object for the same money. It's a book in which you don't have to turn the pages quite so often, where the margins are wider and more comfortable, where if you're watching an HD movie and you feel as though you're really grasping some of the scale and some of the detail that's in this picture. And that in the series articles, I did boil it down to four key features that I really liked about Android that made it so hard for me to return back to my lifestyle of iPhone. But the large screen is probably the definitive one of the four. And so when I realized that I really did miss the iPhone that much, I had a Samsung Galaxy S3 for a long time. And I realized that, look, I mean, you're just using this day after day after day, and you keep telling yourself that this is just sort of like your Wi-Fi iPod in the pocket. The next step was, well, let's get my SIM reprovisioned so I can at least put it inside the Android phone and just use it as, you know, just use it as a connection to the internet occasionally if I want to do that. And I did that with the idea that I've got a SIM extractor tool. I keep it in my wallet because, you know, you know how it is. You got this tiny little tool. You're going to lose it unless you have it right in your wallet where you mm-hmm. can find it at all times. And my idea was that I'm sure that I'll probably, you know, I'll have the SIM inside the Samsung when I'm doing on a day when I'm doing a lot of driving. I'll keep it inside the iPhone when I'm doing a lot of other things. But the fact of the matter is that once that SIM got inserted inside the Galaxy S3, I just didn't find myself missing the iPhone. And that was the weirdest thing, because as someone who writes about technology, I like to think that I'm good at finding an objective opinion about things, where I certainly have my opinions about things, but I like to be able to say categorically, here's the reason why I believe those sort of things. And yet I had to keep coming down to the fact that the Galaxy was going to be a better phone for me, and the reasons why I use a phone, and that the reasons why I was sticking to my iPhone were because it had that lovely Apple logo on the back of it. And I've been an iPhone user, I mean, not just since day one. I mean, I was fortunate enough to get a briefing after Steve Jobs announced it in January, and I got like 45 minutes of hands-on time with an actual working device. And I remember how excited I was just to try this thing that was completely brand new. And I have this legacy with Apple that goes all the way back when I was in 5th, 6th, 7th grade, and I first used an Apple II Plus or 2E. And it's just so hard to have to tell myself that I have found something that I actually like better than an Apple product, and now I'm sort of required to switch to this other Apple product, or else I'm sort of a fraud, aren't I?
Well, how much of this is based on the physical form of the phone versus the operating system?
The big screen is a very big deal. Three out of those four reasons, though, had to do with things I liked about Android, not just the hardware. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to be very specific about these other things. I'm not gonna go into the head-to-head roundup between Google Now and Siri or isn't it, or here's how easy it is to access a drop-down menu. It really wasn't these, I really didn't want to get bogged down in these nitpicky details. I really want to get to the big, big, broad sort of issues. And there are just so many things about Android that I preferred. One of them was the keyboard, because I spent a lot of time capturing text on my phone. And so I really need to be able to type quickly and accurately. And I could just type so much faster on an Android phone, partly because the screen is larger and therefore the buttons are larger, but also because you have the option of modifying how the keyboard works. Whereas iOS, I mean, it's an Apple product, which means that by default, the philosophy is, here, we have designed it to be perfect. Why would you want to change something that's perfect? We are smarter than you. We understand this better than you. We think more about this than you do. So we're giving you the thing that's perfect. Samsung and Android are saying, we don't necessarily, we're taking a good guess at it, but if you don't like it, we're going to let you change it. And one of the things you can do is not only change the methods of inputting text, but also if you want, you can buy a third-party keyboard and install it. I use a third-party keyboard called SwiftKey, which is amazing at its ability to predict what you're typing based on context and sentence structure. Whereas iOS will auto-complete the word if you've typed in the first couple of characters in it, mm-hmm. SwiftKey will not only do that, but will also say, well, if you start a sentence with I bet the next word is going to be love. And so we'll just sort of throw that up there to, if you want to tap this button, I'll type in love. Then, oh, he's typed I love. I bet it's either you or burritos. So I'm going to put up you and burritos, maybe a third option. And I can just tear through these things so, so quickly. One of the things that was very controversial, as it turned out, about that piece was, I find that because I type really, really, really fast on these virtual keyboards, I find that I was activating the speech to text button on iOS about every second or third sentence. And every time that happened, I got so frustrated and so annoyed. I can honestly say that it was the only thing, probably about any Apple product, that made me hate that product in that moment. Mm-hmm. And so, because I'm sort of got this idea in my head that's maybe even half formed, I'm just making a note in Evernote or something, so I remember it, so I can write it up later on. And right in the middle of the sentence, I hear boom, boom, like, what? Hi, I'm here to take your dictation. Yeah, actually, you're interrupting me, and now I have to go back to the sentence that now I'm going to turn you off and try to get my flow back again. Will you please just shut up and let me type? So there's that. Another element was just how easy it is to move data between apps on Android. They have a sharing mechanism that is pretty much infinitely extensible. So in iOS, we're used to how easy it is to take a photo and put it on Twitter or put it on Facebook. That sort of extensibility affects pretty much every Android app with every kind of piece of information that can be categorized. I love the way that if I'm want to navigate to a friend's house, I can just go to the address book, expose the address somehow, tap on it, and then send that address to pretty much any app inside this device that knows how to deal with an address. So sometimes maybe I'll be sending it to Waze because I want like really good live traffic. Sometimes it's someplace I've never driven before, so I really want it to go to the Google map, the Google navigation app for better turn-by-turn directions. Or maybe I just want to send it into Twist because I just want that my friend to get notifications as I go. And it's just emblematic of how much easier it is to share information inside Android. On the iPhone, I really would have to, the only way to really do that consistently is to use cut, copy, and paste, which is nice. I'm not begrudging cut, copy, and paste. I use cut, copy, and paste. I would vote for cut, copy, and paste if it were running for a spot on my local school board. Love cut, copy, and paste. But again, it's another one of those points where I find myself getting things done much, much more quickly on Android than on iOS. And other things were just the ways that I just love the greater openness of Android. It gets back to something that really infuses every part of the experience. You can understand why iOS doesn't do a really good job at managing data between apps. Partly it's because of how tightly sandboxed it is, but I think mostly it's because iOS truly was never, the iPhone was never designed to be a third-party app host. I really do believe that they were very, very confident that people would use web apps for everything and they would never have to open an app store for everything, for anything. So a lot of that core level infrastructure that you need just isn't there. But the other part of it is what I was getting to earlier, that Apple has a philosophy of, we know more than you do about how software works and how hardware works and how to design things so that people will enjoy the user experience. They are correct about this because they do spend all of their time thinking about this, whereas we, you know, money consumers, they'll spend maybe a couple hours in a phone store messing around with a piece of hardware. They don't really think about it that much. And the truth of the matter is that iPhones and iOS devices are a lot easier to use. I'm sorry, I should narrow that. I'm talking specifically about iPhones. iPads are still rule the world. But iPhones really are easier to use to start off with. But the fact that Android allows you to make changes as you go to gradually create a custom fit for you and the way that you manage your device, it's not as easy to use for the first couple of weeks as an iPhone is, but I find that after a month, after 2 months, after 3 months, after 4 months, it keeps getting easier and easier and easier and quicker and quicker and quicker. Because every time, it seems like every time there's something about this device that you don't like, there's a way to fix it or correct it. And the example that I use in the series of articles is this really cool app called Shush for Android. Where there was kind of a little public kerfuffle, I think it was last year, when somebody in the New York Times wrote a post about how somebody's iPhone started making noise in the middle of like a symphony, some sort of really quiet hush hush performance where you're not really supposed to turn off your phones beforehand. But this person decided, oh well, I've got this mechanical switch on the side of my iPhone that if I put it into this position, it silences the device. So that's not gonna be a problem. What he did not know was that he had set an alarm or some sort of a reminder, and he didn't know that the switch is actually just the ringer silence. Doesn't mean silence the whole device. So the iPhone, doing something that was actually quite correct, the philosophy there was that, well, the user told me specifically to make sure I make this noise on this day at this time. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that desire overrides any other expression of what I should do right now. So I should definitely make that noise. My reaction to that, when there was a lot of discussion about that in the blogs and with commentators, was that there should at least be a setting somewhere deep inside. So that if a person wants to say the mute switch affects all noise whatsoever instead of just ringers and just text and stuff like that, because if someone would be confused by the presence of that setting, they won't find it unless they go looking for it. And if someone goes looking for it, that means that they are really disappointed with the way that the phone is designed to work. And so that'd be a good thing to do. So on Android, there is a default mode for how to silence the phone. But the cool thing is that with this app installed, when I take the volume all the way down to zero, instead of it just simply muting the phone, another dialog box pops up provided by the app that says, okay, well, I've muted the phone. If you'd like, you can check this option and I will automatically turn the ringer back and all the noise back on again and after an interval that you specify. So it's easy to simply say, okay, great, turn everything back on again after the movie's over. I didn't switch just for this little app, but it's little things like that that usually, if there's something wrong with this or something I don't like about it, there's a way that I can take control over it and override whatever decision Google or Samsung made. And so it's these little things that, again, the shocking realization that I made that kind of really solidified my decision was that I find that it's easier for me to use the Samsung than it is for me to use the iPhone at this juncture. Again, for me and for the things that I use a phone for. I'm not saying that in any way that the iPhone is not as good as the Galaxy S3. And no way am I saying that iOS is not as good as Android. As a matter of fact, my biggest fear as I was writing this was that this was going to be used as a really, really stupid example for people who really want to make the case of, oh, yes, Apple has ceased to innovate, and by maintaining by trying to become the stylish company, they've allowed Google to eclipse them, and Microsoft is also going to eclipse them, and the company's now doomed. Doomed, I say. You see, no less a personage than Andy Anatko himself has abandoned Apple of jumping off the ship before it sinks. I'm like, no, I didn't say that. As a matter of fact, paragraph two, I said I'm not saying that. Now you're being silly, and now you're making me feel very, very sad that I wrote this, sir.
Right. And on the flip side, you've got the Apple faithful, or some of them, who were very disappointed in your piece, and they felt that you'd personally betrayed them. So what's your reaction to that when people say, oh, Andy, clearly you were paid by Samsung or X, Y, or Z, that you're a terrible person, you're out of touch, and to have no idea what you're talking about?
Well, it's lovely when someone is so silly, because I mean, if someone says, I'm not sure that you really understand how important it is to people to have a simplified experience, that the vast majority of people really are eager to give up that kind of hands-on control in exchange for having something that's simple and a little bit more reliable. It's like, okay, well, I have to actually now look deep inside myself and reevaluate my own choices and my decisions to make sure that I really had considered that as thoroughly as if I had to. If someone says, oh, I can't follow you on Twitter anymore because you like something that I don't like, it's like, oh, that's not my responsibility at all. You're kind of stupid and silly and crazy, and I'm not responsible for other people's stupidity and silliness and craziness. I understand how it can become a passionate issue, and this is why I think the last section of that series, to me, was probably the most heartfelt, because I ended really by talking about how tribalism is starting to ruin the Apple community and really all communities of technology. That it should not be in any way important what logo of what device that you're using. And you shouldn't feel as though you have to be faithful to this multi-billion dollar company. There was one quote that I was so pleased when Jason decided to make it into a poll quote, which is that, you know, if you give half of a damn about what multi-billion dollar company is, quote, winning, unquote, against what other multi-billion dollar company, you desperately need to drop some acid and spend some time in an ashram. Because I mean, there's so many people who feel as though if someone says something nice about a product that you don't, that competes with a product that you own, you are saying something nasty, not only about that product that they own, but about themselves and their choices. And you shouldn't be that emotionally connected to this consumer item that you own. It's a tool. You should love what this tool does for you and how it enhances your life, makes your life easier, and also broadens your perspective and broadens your capabilities. You should love that. You shouldn't love the company that makes it, and you shouldn't love the physical device itself. To the people who are reasonable, I can only say that I'm sorry that this disappoints them, but that if it reassures them about anything else that they might have heard me write, that they might have liked, that when I say nice things about a competitor of Apple, that only underscores the sincerity of the rather voluminous praise that I've given other Apple products, including the iPhone, in the past. The thing that I'm on guard against is that I don't want my affection for Apple to cloud my interpretation of every new thing that they do. I still remember what it was like when I was a kid, and I eagerly awaited the release of George Lucas's next movie, Radioland Murders, because, oh, it's George Lucas, and he's the guy behind Star Wars, and he was the producer behind Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I love everything that George Lucas does. This is going to be incredible. This is going to be a great movie. And it really was not a very good movie at all. It was weak, and it was slow-paced, and it was kind of confusing, and it kind of taught me that you can't tell yourself that you like everything this person does, because that's not really praise for their work. That's praise for the cult that you yourself have erected around this person. I mean, George Lucas is not responsible for the amount of affection that I've erected around his life and his work. I think he would like me to really appreciate what he does for what he does. And I would like to think that people can believe the things that I tell them, that they might disagree with me. My opinion may not even be applicable or relevant to how they use devices and what they expect of new products, but they can at least believe that it's coming from valid sources, a lot of consideration, a lot of thought, and a fear of not getting my facts right, or, you know, being the last person to discover I got my head up my butt. So if I lose some people along the way, then I think those are people I was going to lose at some point anyway.
Right. So when you switched, were there any things that you missed about the iPhone?
Oh yeah, for sure. I really miss Siri. And I think that a lot of the side-by-side comparisons of Google Now versus Siri miss the point that they're two very different things. The fact that they're sort of search-based micro browsers, so to speak, that are tailored for certain kinds of information, that's only a tangential overlap between what these two functions do. I love how I love how Siri really is an alternative user interface for a whole bunch of functions. I mean, there's so many functions that don't actually require you to look at a screen or tap into a keyboard. It's not a convenience thing. It's that if you just want to be reminded that I should check on this roast in 35 minutes, what's easier than simply holding down a button, say, set a reminder for 35 minutes, and you got a voice feedback saying timer set for 35 minutes. There's nothing easier than saying set an appointment for lunch with Ted on Thursday afternoon on 53rd Street, and it just simply happens. I wish that I had that sort of functionality on the Android phone, because now for those sort of things, I do have to kind of drill into specific apps. Android does, and even Google Now, does have voice recognition, but it's not nearly as polished. I can create a reminder, I can create a countdown, I can create a calendar thing, but it really does require that I phrase it the way that it expects it to be phrased, whereas Siri will just take apart every element of the sentence that I just spoke into it and figure out what I meant from it. So of everything, that's probably the one thing that the one software feature that I miss the most. In terms of hardware, nothing can touch the iPhone's camera. And I miss that a lot. The Galaxy S3 has a very, very good camera in and of itself. When the iPhone 5 came out, I did probably the most comprehensive camera tests I'd done in years, where I took five different phones out, and my Micro Four Thirds, like traditional Panasonic camera, out, took the same shots with all five or six devices, did a series of like 12 of these things, not just like studio setups, but taking a walk through Boston, going indoors, going outdoors, taking a wide range of photos. I posted them to my Flickr account, hiding, just giving them little labels and hiding the identities of these cameras, just invited people to pick out which are the best ones, which are the worst ones. And I was very, very pleased to find that in so many of these shots, people actually preferred the Samsung Galaxy S3 to even the iPhone 5. But when it comes down to the sort of shots where they're not ideal situations, you're not outdoors, the lighting is not very good, there's a lot of shadow detail that you want to try to capture, you want to get a portrait, you want to get really good, accurate skin tones, man alive, nothing will touch an iPhone. So I'm looking forward to the 2013 series of phones out there. I'm not sure that I value a camera so much that I would allow that to trump every other consideration. But really, if there's ever another phone that's within one letter grade, let's say, of the phone that I have right now, and it has a much better camera, oh boy, I'll switch in a heartbeat. I often find myself carrying my iPhone 4S in my pocket, and I'm really just using it as a camera, because as a tiny little slim pocket camera, you know, with Wi-Fi and with connections to the internet, it really is a world beater.
Right. Now, a lot of times people bring up the point that if you have an iPhone and you have iTunes and you're living in the Apple ecosystem, syncing is so much easier. But does that matter to you at all with Android, because you're doing everything over the air anyway, or are you using it with your Mac and you find that relationship is okay?
It works out just fine, and for a couple of reasons. Now, I'm doing a follow-up for TechHive sometime this week, which I'm going to answering a lot of questions that have been sent in by people. And that really is one of the big ones. How do you handle syncing data? And I think one of the differences is that Apple sort of sowed the seeds of their own defeat for me, because they themselves sort of started encouraging people that, why would you want to, this is a wireless world, why would you want to tether something to a device with copper wire to sync when there's a whole world of internet that you can use to sync things from? So already I was using Wi-Fi and the internet as central depositories of data to sync through. iCloud is a really, really big win for me on the iPad. However, I was never using it on the iPhone, because I use my iPhone and my iPad in very different ways. So iCloud would have been a big hurt if I had been relying on it on the iPhone. I don't use it at all, so that's okay. I still have access to Dropbox, so that really is the center of my cloud syncing for all kinds of my work. So that was negligible. I started using reminders and notes in iOS as part of my workflow for the first time like last year. Mm-hmm. because for whatever reason, it just wasn't it doesn't matter how good a tool is. For some reason, there has to be a way that you work in which this is a solution to a problem. And for some reason, just having a centralized reminder system and a centralized notes system just wasn't part of my workflow until last year. And as soon as I started using them effectively, this had nothing to do with any desire to switch. I sort of instinctively believed that, yeah, but what if you want to access those notes on a device that's not an Apple device? What if I want my reminders to be used on something that is not an Apple device, not an iOS device, not a macOS device? And so independently of any other decision, I transitioned all of those onto Evernote and other apps that are multi-platform. So that, again, was not a problem because the Android marketplace, the Google Play Store, which has all the Android apps on it, Almost every single multi-platform data tool that I was using on the iPhone had a one-to-one feature complete analog on Android. So it was just as simple as download the app for Android, sign into that device, and now, boom, every single piece of data that I've been collecting over the past year was now available on the Android device, easy as you please. The only thing that's a little bit tricky is syncing media and music. Mm-hmm. Even then, it's sort of six of one, half dozen the other in terms of how easy it is to go. Here again, Apple sort of helped me to make the transition by releasing iTunes 11. I would always say that iTunes is a real force multiplier. When you're trying to manage your music on a mobile device, it will just make everything so much simpler to use. And with iTunes 11, Apple actually made it more difficult, at least for me, to manage multiple playlists and keep those things maintained. I still love smart playlists, but in terms of having those human curated playlists that let you assemble things very, very quickly and decide what you want to watch, what you want to listen to at any given moment, it just took it down a notch and made it that much easier for me to work with a device that doesn't necessarily require iTunes in order to sync. And there are a whole bunch of tools out there. I use a tool called iSync, or could be called iSyncer. I'd have to double check it. You connect via USB. It recognizes the presence of the device. It will sync any playlist off of iTunes you'd like. I choose this solution over others because it will also sync play counts and skip counts. So most of my smart playlists on iTunes are fueled by knowing that, okay, well, here is a playlist of 2 gigabytes worth of music that I really, really like that I haven't heard recently. And so when it gets synced back, it knows that he listened to that Sinatra track yesterday. So we'll now remove this from that playlist and replace it with something he hasn't heard in the past 2 weeks. So that was something that I missed until I found a syncing solution that would actually restore that kind of functionality. So now that I've got all that working, I don't miss it. It is a little bit more difficult to keep this device synced up with all of its media, but it's certainly a surmountable problem. Although I lose that kind of ease of syncing from iTunes, remember that I do get the win of this. Most Android, almost all Android devices have a micro SD card slot. So whenever I want to just take a video file from a DVD I've ripped and put it on the device, it's always annoyed me that I have to first add it to my iTunes library and then sync it from the iTunes library into this device through an intermediary of checkboxes that tell me, yes, please take Pixar's Brave and do please put this on this phone. Whereas on the Android device, really all I have to do is drag that MP4 file onto this card, then put the card inside the device, and then the video player on Android will simply find it and play it without really making me going through hoops to do it.
Mm-hmm. Given your experiences, do you think that there are any lessons that Apple could learn from Android?
They don't necessarily need to make iOS as much of the wild, wild west as Android is. I mean, for heaven's sake, if you want to, quote, jailbreak, unquote, an Android device, you go into settings, you flip a switch that says, allow this phone to run software from unsigned app libraries. And now, essentially, you could run any software from everywhere. Because the iPhone does benefit greatly from being as tightly locked down and as tightly managed as it is. But they do need to understand that if there's a small lesson, it's that there are two different kinds of ease of use. There's the sort of ease of use that makes something easy to use for the first week that someone owns it. And then there's the ease of use that keeps it easy to use a year from the day they buy it. And so I think that sometimes that they put a feature or put a design on the wrong side of that line, where they are so concerned about keeping something simple that they ship something that's shipped down and underpowered, that they're so focused on the features that 80% of the users or 90% of the users are think that matters, that they forget that it's a different 80 to 90% for every person. That if you simply omit 10% of the features, that the feature set that this phone can do, you're leaving a lot of people in the dust as time after time after time something works adequately but not really, really well. So I would like to see Apple sort of loosen the purse strings a little bit and allow their users to have a little bit more control. I mean, as I said a little bit earlier, that it kind of boggles me that something as simple as a user setting buried deep in the interface where a neophyte user will never see it and will never be confused by it, but it's waiting there like a precious little jewel for somebody who wants to dig with their hands in the sand for all of 10 minutes to find this thing that's buried there. And they flip that switch and suddenly a problem that they were experiencing with a phone no longer exists and it works that much better. It's a little bit more custom fit for what they do. I don't understand why that is considered to be a really, really bad thing to do to the phone, because you don't want to give your users infinite options because they'll cause infinite problems. But there is a happy medium between what iOS is now and what Android is that I think Apple should start steering a little bit closer towards.
Well, I think that's something that a lot of us want, not just in iOS, but also in the macOS, is that pro switch or the I know what I'm doing switch.
Yeah.
Where things do become much easier to share information, for example, on iOS. As you say, on Android, it's easier. Yes, Apple offers the share button with some limited options, but much of the time you find, no, that's not really going to work. I have to put it on Dropbox, so then I can take it to a different app, mung with it there, and then finally get it to where I want it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, moving... we haven't talked about iPad, I'll just say that my iPad use is completely unaffected by all of this, because first of all, Android on large tablets is still just absolutely hopeless. The apps aren't the app marketplace for Android phones is rich and robust. I mean, I would not have made this switch if there weren't the apps that I needed on it, but it's still a hopeless situation. There's just nothing that takes advantage of a 10-inch tablet on there. But even so, I find myself sort of weaning myself off of iCloud. Because I just feel as though it's a wonderful service for a certain kind of user who just wants to make sure that the docs that they create on their desktop are also available on their phone and on their tablet and on their MacBook in addition to their iMac. But for someone who has a little bit more robust need for document syncing, you really have to go with SkyDrive or Dropbox or any of the alternatives. And unfortunately, that sort of has a cascade. It's so important to occasionally take a couple steps back from your workflow and how you do things and just look at it as objectively as possible. Try to take that step outside of your own body and observe your own decisions and your own behavior. And when I came to really love the iPad with the first generation hardware, and came to find myself just using it time and time and time again and finding that, gee, I don't even need to take my MacBook out with me because my iPad with this Bluetooth keyboard will do everything that I really wanted to do. This is great. Only fairly recently did I realize how much I've adapted my workflow to suit the limitations that Apple's imposing on it. Because I do like to have a word processor with formatting in it. And right now, because Apple really has done almost nothing to support rich text formatting for third-party software, the only solution to that is Pages. And their doc syncing solution, it works well, but the only solution that really works well through iCloud is, again, iWork and the iLife apps. Mm-hmm. So Scrivener, which is a writing tool that I absolutely adore, that I don't hesitate to recommend to anybody. It really, for someone who does writing on a professional level, writing the sort of things that take more than a day to conceive, research, and write, Scrivener is the tool you want. It's for Windows, it's for Mac. And I've kind of stopped using it for most of my work because, unfortunately, it's not available for iPad. I really have to switch to, if I want to use the Apple iPad and Apple's document syncing service, I have to use the Apple piece of software in order to do it. And it wasn't until I did take that those two steps out of my body and realized that, wait a minute, so if Apple makes any change to the way any of this works, you are hosed. You have to simply you've given away so much and done so much adaptation to trust all of your life to this one company's products. And if it really is the best solution for you, there's nothing wrong with that, but is that the best solution for you? And so over the past couple of months, I realized that, gee, I really don't like the fact that I have to go through hoops in order to share a document from iCloud to somebody else. It's very much a mother may I sort of procedure to do that. And so I've really started transitioning most of my work back to Dropbox for syncing. And although I've never been a fan of the Markdown text editing scheme, I've really tried to sort of train my brain to use it, because if the iPad still doesn't support great text editing with any app but Pages, Pages is now a big enough liability that I will switch to Markdown so I can do all my word processing in text, which means that now I can, which has the added benefit that now I can switch back to Scrivener for all my projects on the desktop. And when Scrivener comes, when Literature and Latte comes out with an iPad version of Scrivener in the near future, and if it's wonderful, then I will be very, very well poised to complete my workflow edge to edge with the app that I want that's not made by Apple, using a sync mechanism that gives me the greatest amount of flexibility. So this is, these are the sort of things that that make me worry about the decisions that Apple is making. And again, it's not anything, not even close to, I think that Apple is doomed or Apple is in a tailspin or anything like that. The numbers, the sheer numbers of how much money they're making and how many of these products they're selling shows that they have figured out who they want to sell to, and that person is eager to buy the stuff that they make. What I wonder about is if 5 years from now we're going to be talking about the iPhone and the iPad and the Mac OS not as the tool that lets you do anything you want to imagine, but the tool that's exceptionally good at the limited number of things that you wanted it to do when you first bought it and used it for the first month. It kind of disappoints me that so many of these technologies that Apple's developed that I really, really like have not been able to grow and expand with me. And there was a point at which I really did have to jump off of this horse and jump onto another horse.
So for those who've listened this far without setting their listening devices on fire,
Apple sells you another one. That's how Apple's paying me to write this sort of stuff.
So what's it going to take for you to switch back to an iPhone?
A bunch of things are going to have to happen. Number one, they have to do a larger screen for real. I had it in the back of my mind that this might be a good time for me to switch in the fall. I was holding off to see what iOS 6 was going to be like and what the iPhone 5 was going to be like. And when iOS 6 was very, very good, but didn't address a lot of the things that I really liked about Android, and when iPhone 5 was really okay, fine, they gave me a couple of extra lines in a scrolling list, but it really isn't effectively a bigger screen, that really left the door open for me. So a larger screen would be part of it, but I think that they're going to have to make it a lot easier for me to be productive with this device. It's going to have to be about sharing data and moving data between apps, and not just between the apps that Apple has written and published, but between all apps everywhere. And they're going to have to make it a little bit easier for me to fix things about it that I don't really like. A lot of people have made the point that there is a very, very lush jailbreaking community for, if you go to the city of jailbreak your phone and go to the city of repositories, you'll find a lot of the customization tools that I really, really want. And that is a credible point to make. But I would further say that the fact that there are these lush tools and this lush alternative available kind of points out to the fact that I think Apple is really leaving a bunch of people behind. And again, that has nothing to do with the success of the company, but I'm not sure if you remember when the slogans for Apple used to be the power to be your best, mm-hmm. and the computer for the rest of us. And I would worry if in 2015, 2016, it's the power that lets you be pretty good, just fine. The power to be just perfectly as good as 80% of whatever anybody else is doing, and the computer for the people who really are easy for us to predict what it is that they expect and want to do with this device. It's like, there are times with, I'm limiting these comments to the iPhone, but I don't feel as though the iPhone is for the crazy ones, the square peg in the round hole. It's for the apple shaped peg in the apple shaped hole at this point.
But doesn't this basically realize Steve Jobs' statement that the computer or this computer-like device should be an appliance, and so not something you should have to mess around with, but look, it makes toast.
Well, I mean, C was wrong about a lot of things. and that is a lovely and a valid statement when it's applied very broadly, but I don't think anybody wants to go to the sofa store and find one sofa and say, this is the sofa. We've designed the perfect sofa. Here's your receipt. What? Yeah, we charge it to you. Now it's already in your car. You're welcome. We've removed from you the complexity of shopping for a sofa. And when someone says, well, no, actually I wanted something like I'm on an ottoman. Well, people don't use ottomans. I do. Well, you're not people then. I mean, there's you can design a toaster that way. But the problem is that they're not. Then you get some guy who approaches this machine with a bagel, and then he's kind of hosed. And then you realize that not everybody wants to put in two slices of thin bread and come out with toast of a certain shade. There's a need for a wide spectrum of devices. It's a wonderful philosophical discussion to get into, because I think that Apple can succeed the way they do because there are so many alternatives for people who don't fit into that kind of Apple mold. And I'm also not saying that people shouldn't be ideal consumers for Apple devices. But if Apple were in a position where they really do have to serve the needs of people with a wide spectrum of needs, I wonder how successful they would be. I wonder how long it would take them to adapt and modify what they do so that they can actually sell to a wider variety of people. We have noticed that at first Apple said that resisted the urge to create a larger screen of any kind. And then they came out with the iPhone 5, which says, see, we've solved the problem of larger screens by making it into a better screen. And now it seems as though every rumor is saying that they are going to produce an iPhone with a legitimately larger screen. And right now that's just a rumor, but I wouldn't be surprised because the numbers are saying that people just want things with a legitimately larger screen. And of course, Apple will never say, well, of course, we guessed wrong to begin with. But when you toss these devices into the scrum with other devices that are kind of similar, but with a range of choices, that's the only time that Apple will ever learn that, okay, it turns out that a 7-inch tablet is a useful and popular thing. It turns out that we can ship an iPad that's a little bit smaller without a piece of sandpaper for it to help people to sand their fingertips down to operate the buttons. I think that when Apple listens to what customers are doing, and Apple listens to when customers are saying that here's an alternative device that's selling extremely well, and the reason why it's selling extremely well is because you guessed wrong when you said here's the perfect device for all kinds of people. That causes them to mature a little bit. I'm sorry if my answer is all over the place, but it's not a very concise sort of problem for them to solve. I guess I could sum it up by saying that how many companies really want to be Bang & Olufsen,
right?
Which they make beautifully designed equipment that practically nobody can afford and which don't deliver a range of features that are relevant to the market for audio equipment. And they find that there are enough people who adore their design aesthetic and adore the things and value the same things that Apple also value and admire. But these are not – it's a way to sort of turn yourself into an emphatically niche product that doesn't speak to the greatest number of people. I mean, Apple shows off its excellence with a product like the iPad or with a product like the MacBook Air. A company like Google shows off their excellence by shipping the $250 Chromebook, where it is not it's made out of plastic, not milled aluminum. It is not the single most sophisticated, sleek, and powerful computer known to mankind, but it's a very functional, powerful laptop that costs $250 that more people can afford. You know, you can fault Amazon for not producing something as well made and with a high level of quality control as the iPad, but give them credit that when they sold the very first Kindle book reader, it cost something like $450. Mm-hmm. And although they now make for less than $450 a Kindle with the color screen, multi-touch, ability to play movies and run apps, they have also took essentially the feature set of the original $450 Kindle, and now they sell the exact same thing for $69. And what is more glorious? A beautifully designed, perfect, flawless, industrially designed object that few people can afford, or some kid who can get this for his birthday and now they have access to 20,000 books for free for life in one single device that they can put in their back pocket and not worry that the thing's going to get stolen out of them. There are all kinds of different ways to attend to the needs of users. And I'm glad that there are so many different companies taking so many different approaches to that, because that's the only way that the needs of everyone is going to be covered.
Right. Okay. And I'd like to wrap up with you removing the temptation for me to write in the comments, "Oh, for crying out loud," and state, just so it's very clear to everyone reading this, that you are not telling people what to buy, that these are the opinions and views of one Mr. Andy Anatko.
Absolutely. I mean, that's if there's anything I didn't like about the way that I wrote that series, is that I really want – it's not so much that I felt as though I could convince people that there's a certain number of people who will never see this as a simple statement of, this is just my choice for my computing needs, for my phone. I'm not making a larger statement about Apple or anything. So I didn't believe that I could talk those kind of people down from that cliff. I did feel as though when they made those complaints that I could really make them look stupid by pointing to several different places. Here is right. Paragraph number two, in which I said, this is the story of a dude who switched phones. This is not a story about Apple losing their way. All I can say is I'm sorry, and largely I'm sorry that you really do need external validation for your own choices. If I were ever to create a business plan and a mission statement for what I do as a writer, I think that in Latin, carved in some sort of rare wood over the lintel of my worldwide headquarters would be, I am my purpose in life is not to validate you and your personal prejudices. It's something else entirely, but it's certainly, I can't tell you, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's certainly not that. I'm still a very nice person, Chris.
You are. I know.
My mother loved me a lot, and she had a good reason to love me because I was a very lovable person. Still am.
You still are. Every Thank time you. I see and speak with you, you are as lovable as ever. So if you haven't raised or lowered your blood pressure in the last week or so, you may want to check out Andy's Why Switch from iPhone to Android, which is on TechHive.com, and it's also on Macworld.com. I will provide links in the show notes, and thank you very much for being here, Andy.
Thanks so much, Chris.
And that wraps up this edition of the Macworld Podcast. I'd like to thank Andy Anatko and, of course, you for listening. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to drop us a line at podcast@macworld.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 415-967-3622. This is Chris Breen reminding you that you can find more Apple, macOS, iOS, and technology news, views, and information at macworld.com. See you around.